open up the champagne. Pop. It's my house, come on, turn it up. Hear a knock on the door and the night begins. Cause we've done this before, so you come on in. Make yourself at my home, tell me where you've been. Pour yourself something cold.
You're listening to Cleveland Browns Daily on ESPN 850 WKNR. Now here are your hosts, Nathan Zagura and Matt Wilhelm.
Hello there. Hope everybody had a happy Mother's Day, a great weekend. Nathan Zagura, Matt Wilhelm, Jason Gibbs here. Gibbs, it has been brought to my attention by Scott in Shelby and confirmed now by Gibbs and Casey Coolis at the Really Big Show is challenging us to a golf match.
Yeah, they want to hit the links. Riz is like, hey, get the CBD guys. I feel like coming soon, there's going to be a CBD RBS golf challenge.
I like it.
Are they challenging us simply because everything that happens after our show is extremely unathletic and cannot golf?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I think Riz just wants to hang out with us.
That would be great.
I think that's fantastic.
Casey, Fontana's got a good game. Casey can drive the golf
ball. I may be the worst of everyone.
No, I'm right there, my friend.
I haven't played yet this year.
So who would it be? Would it be 4-on-4?
We might need a fourth.
Oh, the kid.
Dr. Kurt.
We have options.
Because Gerard,
we go get Dr. Kurt.
What have they set up, what is the parameters? What is the match? What are we doing?
I was told we can't count Gerard.
No, they're trying not to count me either. That doesn't work. Everybody has to play.
We could do a four on four. Gerard needs to get out and play. Gerard's been practice range guy.
I do too.
All right. Well, we're in. We accept your challenge.
It's a fun-filled day. Nothing crazy. There's nothing behind it other than Rizzo's like, I think we should all get together and golf.
Gibbs,
it's a great idea.
I'm going to say with Rizzo will obviously be team captain for the RBS. Zagura will be team captain for us. And by captain's orders, there's no boozing on the course, Gibbs.
I want Gibbs to play in whatever environment he wants to play.
Hey, I don't have to booze. I think people sometimes think that I just drink all the time.
Does it hurt you, though? I mean, if that's how you play your best golf, do it.
No, I'm good either way.
I drink too. I get a little
loose. I never drink on the golf course.
Well, that's just dumb.
It's just not what I don't like. It. I rarely do.
I'd say 50-50 for me.
Here's the thing. I can have a beer or two and be totally fine. You know what I mean?
I just like to enjoy the nature.
I'm the same way.
If I have a beer going while I'm golfing, I'm totally good. I'm not trying to pound. It's not like a regular golf outing where I'm just trying to get schnockered.
The only thing I like to drink on a golf course is a John Daly. Like a nice sunny day and you got a John Daly, you're feeling good about yourself. I like that. That I'm fine with.
My favorite thing, I'll do the Arnold Palmer, of course, light. And I'll do my favorite snack on the golf course is the cheese peanut butter crackers.
Okay.
Must have.
You know what a John Daly
is.
Of course. Yeah. Just your Arnold Palmer with a little Tito's vodka.
Correct.
Fantastic. Fine beverage. By the way, we are going to go through on today's show. We got some big guests lined up for you tomorrow, but today we're going to go through. Obviously, we'll take your phone calls, 216-578-0850, all your tweets, at Nathan Zagura, at Browns_Daily. We're going to take a look at the best rookie on each team. You can give us your prediction of who you think is going to be the biggest impact rookie. Andrew Gribble and I debated that on Dog Pound Report, which you can now get in its entirety at clevelandbrowns.com or the Browns mobile app. We're going to look at the running backs on offense and the defensive line on defense. We'll look at the additions to those rooms, the subtractions from those rooms where applicable. And in the case of the running backs, you know, I think we have a pretty clear hierarchy already in that room established. So we'll take a look at those two position previews. We'll get through that. We have a little after further review as well. But how about the Cavs on to the Eastern Conference finals already? Sweet. 8 out of the 16 are done. Not a blemish on their record. Feisty performance from the Hawks yesterday, but in the end, the Cavs just too good.
They were, and I was, I'm still just overly impressed with their three-point shooting, and how can you not? They're setting NBA records.
They made the most threes in a series, and they only played four games in that series.
And
first time ever in a playoff series, NBA record, that they had more three-point field goals than they did two-point field goals. I think it's 79-77 or 79-78 or 80-79, something really close.
It's unbelievable. I mean, Kevin Love yesterday took 15 threes.
Did he score in the fourth quarter? He had the one three-pointer,
he had
right?
one three, yeah.
But otherwise nothing. So we had 24 going into the fourth quarter.
How about this, which I find to be, I think, is somewhat interesting. Maybe it's not that interesting as I look at it, because the same was true for the Hawks. But the only person on the Cavs that didn't attempt the three in this game was Tristan Thompson. 15 for Love, 5 for LeBron, 3 for Kyrie, 4 for JR, 4 for Fry, 1 for Richard Jefferson, 1 for Delly, by the way, not having a good playoffs.
No?
No.
I don't think he's
been
horrible.
Don't think that to be true.
I don't think he's been
horrible. Didn't he play really well in game one, game two?
He had a couple good
moves
yesterday.
Well, that guy Schroeder was just abusing
Friday
him.
Friday night
game
he
one.
Was in yeah. there when they made their run. They were down like 8 points, 9 points in the fourth quarter. LeBron was on the bench. He was part of that group.
All right, hold on. I'm looking here.
Says something to me, though, that Dellavedova is in the game when the game matters.
He's got... In the series against the Hawks, he was 3 for 15 from the floor. He had a total of 13 assists, only 2 turnovers, so that's good.
What's his plus minus?
That's what I'm looking for. It was -6 yesterday. It doesn't have it, at least not in what I'm looking at. But the bottom line is, right now this team has so many weapons and so many options, and it's like when you know those role players, when Channing Frye hit that big three. I mean, just to have that
in
is such a nice weapon. I think we have the highest number and best shooters right now of any team in the NBA. And yes, that does include the Golden State Warriors. Because on the Warriors, yeah, you got Steph, unbelievable. You've got Klay. You've got Draymond. But beyond that, who really is a three-point shooter?
Not Iguodala. Not Barbosa.
Not
Harrison
Barnes.
Yeah. That's really it, right?
Whereas the Cavs, you've got LeBron can shoot threes, although it's not his forte. But Love, JR, Kyrie.
Shump. Dellavedova.
Well, Delly and Channing Frye. Richard Jefferson is a spot-up three-point shooter. I mean, we have so many guys that are just chucking those
trifectas. And how about Channing Frye and the role that he's playing in the playoffs when everybody thought that was the most dumb, insignificant trade we made midseason?
Well, it only seemed dumb and insignificant at first when he wasn't playing. But now he's playing, and he's playing very well.
Well, no, I think the body of work – you know, that he had as of recent. What's a 7-footer, you know, on the team with Mozgov and Tristan to be able to play big and go small? Where did Frye really fit in? You didn't know that. You knew that he's
shooter.
A big guy that could shoot three-pointers, and yep. That's exactly what he's doing for us. And I'll be honest, the one thing that I see, and I see it in our role players more than I see it in our starters, I mean, you got to give JR props on the job they did on Korver most of the series.
He's our best perimeter defender right now.
I mean, Shump has struggled this whole season, I believe. But the effort that has been given, there's a side of Kevin Love that I saw come out in the Hawks series that I haven't seen since
intensity.
He's worn a Cavs uniform. That's flat out.
I would actually say you saw it last year in that Celtics series before he got hurt.
Yeah.
Because he was playing out
of his mind. That was what, game three?
Yep.
Okay. But I meant, yeah, you're right. There was an intensity to him. And I think that both for him and Kyrie – They're realizing how special this opportunity is, and they're embracing it with, you know, every cell in their body to do everything that they can. Because I've seen Kevin Love move his feet more than I've seen him move his feet. I still don't like the half kind of like, I don't want to get hit, but I'm trying to take a charge, you know, which you're never going to get called. Stand there and take it. You know what I mean? Cover your nuts. Stand there and take a charge, will you? You know, three times I think
I was not a fan of the charge drill in high school, by the way.
No.
I'll just go on record
no,
saying that.
Of course,
not
that driving knee.
Yeah.
Right? But I just thought, I've seen Frye, you know, make a hustle play. I just think guys are doing more. The role players on this team are doing more, and it's not just scoring.
I'm going to come out and say it. The Cavs are the favorite right now, as I see it. I think that they are, and I didn't feel that way at all during the season. I thought Golden State and San Antonio are better, but the way that they're playing right now, the ball movement, the pace, the spacing. I mean, these guys are shooting wide open threes.
Yeah.
All the time. The only thing that concerns me is that against San Antonio, can Kawhi prevent LeBron from penetrating so easily and getting those kicks? But if he does, you could have Kyrie do the penetration and the kick. And Kyrie, that left-handed finish he had was filthy.
I said it watching, and I go, dude, his left hand is ridiculous. The one thing, and I don't know why Tyronn Lue lets this happen, is the ground and pound LeBron with 9 seconds left on the play clock, with him pump faking, pivoting his foot, and then settling for not okay. Shoot the three if you're gonna shoot it, because it's a three and it's difficult. That's why they give you one more point. Don't shoot a 22.4-inch shot, foot shot, where you get 2 for. Move back 3 inches and get the damn three. Get the darn three.
Those two shots at the end were both bad shots.
He made one of them. But I'm
even
just like,
said, you know what I like though, in the post game, he did say, he was like, that was a bad shot. All right, that's fine. And we got away with it.
That can't be our go-to.
Not in the finals.
And when you're trying to chew up clock.
And if it is, I want the ball in Kyrie's hand.
100%. We said that last week.
Or JR. Right. We did say that last week. That's right. We certainly did. 216-578-0850. Again, 216-578-0850. Here on CBD, we'll talk about the Browns. We'll get into this team. We'll take your calls. By the way, phase two continues for the veterans today. They were out on the field today going through phase two, which means they're allowed to be out there going against air. It's not practice, not et cetera. They're going against air out there. And then, of course, Thursday, the rookies report. Friday is the first rookie minicamp. Saturday, rookie minicamp at FanFest. And I'm going to give away tickets to FanFest throughout the week on my Twitter, at Nathan Zagura. And then Sunday, the last day of rookie minicamp practice. And then that will wrap up the rookie minicamp. And then we'll start to get into the OTAs for this team as they start to actually be able to start to do some team stuff and see that going forward, which I think is when we'll really start to get an idea of what's going on here.
Absolutely. And I think the reason why we'll see that is because there's a consistency to them being out on the football field, and every coach has a wish list of what they want to get accomplished. You know, I want to have this portion of our playbook installed throughout OTAs. I want to be efficient at this percentage of our playbook by the end of OTAs. And I think for you and I, if we're able to get out to practice, here or there, or if some of them are open to the media,
sure.
It's okay. We're doing A very well. Let's move on to B. So now we're doing A and B. A, B, C. That's what these OTAs really are. And I think Hugh Jackson wanting to put the steps together, to get accomplished. Okay, we got to get through M in a reference to the letters by the end of OTAs. We're going to use that vet mini camp, because when they come back to training camp, A through M, they'll spend 2 days on it. They're going to spend roughly 10 to 12 OTAs and minicamp practices, on that portion of the playbook.
Yep.
But A through M is going to be maybe the first 3 days of training camp, and then they're going to get into the nitty-gritty of expanding it, competing against it, tinkering with it, and putting guys in places that they're going to line up September through January on the football field, running these things, and that muscle memory really comes into play for these guys.
They always say, though, you can't tell anything till the pads come on. Do you think that you can get an idea of things before that?
Absolutely. I do. I think especially for the specialty players, the receivers, the running backs, the DBs, the safeties, some of the blitzes, you can say, especially from the outside, the inside blitzes, you'll kind of have to wait and go later because, the offensive linemen aren't able to protect themselves. But I think if you're seeing guys predominantly line up in certain positions, pads or no pads at a specialty position, then that's most likely where they're going to work.
Yeah. You're going to get to kind of see the way that those things are flowing together. We're not going to get to see the pads popping. We're not going to see the physicality. But we're going to get an idea of some of the concepts of the offense, concepts of the defense.
Correct.
And how quickly, I think, for when you have a rookie class this big, the mental transition is going to be almost as important as the physical. We're going to get an idea of how quickly they are picking up the offense.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for both of these units, essentially, either relearning or learning a new scheme, the one thing that I always enjoyed when I got quality coaching, and that's why, and Nathan, this, as I continue to draw up plays to coach the flag football guys, it's teaching them to play, but then also teaching them why they're doing what they're doing, And that was always very interesting to me. Okay, understanding, when we're in cover three, where are our voids? When we're in cover two, how is an offense going to attack us? And when you know that about what they're going to do, Knowing what you do is very easy. That's why you're a paid professional. But learning the nuances that come along with it is the evolution of getting very good. And when you have 11 guys, as in talking to Al Saunders, the best three, the best four are going to be out there at wide receiver. The running backs are going to be the same. Quarterbacks may rotate, but once a starter's – he's going to get first starter reps.
That's what I'm interested to see, too.
This is not going to be like last year where we're trying to make everybody happy.
Right. And I wonder if we'll get a sense – we should get a sense of just how specialized the packages are going to be. Is it going to be like most teams in the NFL where your front seven or the core of your front seven are together? Basically, so your whole 11 are going to be together 75% of the time.
Every place that I've been, there's ones. When ones get their three or four reps, they come out. Twos get their three, four reps, they come out. And then in this case, because, you know, the expanded roster, then there's threes. You may have a guy go in a sub package here or there, but as you said, 75% of what you do on the practice field is collectively as the unit as you sit right now. Now, a two can become a one and a one become a two if a guy beats out each other, but you're playing with the guys that you're practicing with the guys that you're going to play with.
Well, yeah, and last year you didn't have that because also, though, on game days you didn't have that. You had constant shuffling, especially on the defensive side of the ball, and I don't think that will be the case this year, which I think is going to be a good thing for this defense. 216-578-0850. We could talk Cavs. We'll talk Browns, obviously. It is Cleveland Browns Daily, so give us a call, 216-578-0850. We'll be back with more here on ESPN 850.
Listening to Cleveland Browns Daily on ESPN 850 WKNR.
Welcome back to Cleveland Browns Daily. Nathan Zagura, Matt Wilhelm, Jason Gibbs here in the Dog Bowl in Berea. The veterans did their work earlier today. The rookies come in later this week to get things going for the rookie minicamp. 216-578-0850. By the way, gentlemen, I just saw CBS Sports tweeted out the following. Strange but true, Kevin Love is now a perfect 12-0 in his postseason career. Love has the most wins without a loss in NBA playoff history.
Wow. What? That was...
How about that? Never two, lost a playoff game.
Two series last year?
One series last year
one
and two this
last
year.
One series last year and two this year.
Yeah.
Wow.
How about that, Gibbs?
He
likes it. He likes it. He's got to see it. He's seen it.
Bro.
He's seen it. He's seen it from Kevin Love.
I'm speechless too, man.
What are you guys talking about?
As well.
Nothing.
Kevin Love holds the record for most postseason wins without a loss in NBA history with 12. He's still speechless.
Speechless.
It's having the same effect on him.
I didn't know you were like talking to me. I thought you just kept going and we were like, nothing, don't worry about it. And then you just kept going.
No, we're talking to you.
I'm texting you that Brady and Bowling Green is on hold. Wanting to talk to us.
Well, then let's go talk to him. 216-578-0850. Brady and Bowling Green, welcome to the show.
All right, what's up, guys? Long time listener, first time caller.
Thank you, man. Appreciate
it. And I was wondering what group on the defensive side will be the most successful and be the biggest surprise. How about that? I think it's going to be the linebackers, personally, just because I like the group with Orchard and Kirksey and couple of the new guys we brought in, but what do you guys think?
I think the linebacking group has the biggest chance to surprise and really be impactful with the addition of Ogba, Orchard now in his second year, and he came on strong at the end of the first year. You're going to get
Davis.
Whatever you can out of Mingo. You've got Davis and Kirksey on the inside. Where does Kruger fit in? I think that's going to be interesting to see going forward, but I think that room has the chance to really kind of surprise. I think the D-line has an abundance of players and is solid. I don't believe that it is. It doesn't yet have a dominant player up front. You're adding Carl Nassib to that mix. And then on the back end, you know, you need Joe Hayden to return to form. You've got a ton of corners in that room, a ton of corners. And the safeties are going to be new. That's a group that is going to be very interesting to see how it holds up.
I think the defensive line is going to surprise you. And this is, as you said, we don't have the dominant player, but I think if we've had guys make flashes in a bad defensive scheme, they've played well in a stretch here or there.
Sure.
They've made the flash plays. Dez Bryant, you know, in 14 and 15, very productive. Again, you added Nassib. So I think these guys, given the scheme that they're going to play in, are going to be given opportunities to make plays. So they will surprise you you'll surprise with how well we stop the run and how much production or I'll say pass rush will come internally as opposed to last year. And I think when it comes to who's going to be most solid, your surprise was the linebackers. I think the linebackers are going to be very solid. Ogba is going to be, he should start for you. His role should be limited to rushing the passer. Don't give him any more of that. Now, we know Kruger, because of 14, extremely productive as a rush linebacker, but learned how to play Sam last year, the opposite. So where he fits in that mix, you have a guy that can do both. And we know he excels as a rusher. And at times, he wasn't a liability in space as a pass defender, but it's not a priority for him. Mingo, where do you put him? I don't know. He was the pass guy, the pass defender. Orchard was the sack guy. Where does he fit now? And as you mentioned, going back to our first segment, I don't want to split reps.
Right.
Put the four of these guys on the football field. Put the who you think are the ones are the ones. Who you think are the twos, and Ogba probably is going to start as a two simply because he's a rookie learning this defense. Whoever wins the right to go play Sam and is the best rush are the two guys that should start. Regardless of where you drafted, Orchard or Mingo or whoever, that's got to go out the window. We don't owe anybody anything other than this city and this fan base some wins.
Yeah.
So that's what we need to focus on, right? And then lastly, I think, as you said, to me, the biggest question mark is the back end. You have Joe Hayden. Which Joe Hayden's going to show up? Pro Bowl Joe Hayden? Liability Joe Hayden? Injury plague Joe Hayden? Tremont Williams, I think, would excel opposite Joe Hayden. But last year, we could tell he's not a number one corner anymore. And
right.
We saw that when he had to play number one corner. He became a guy. And then you look at our safeties and the inexperience at the safety position. You got Moore. I like that free agent signing on a budget. But Poyer, is Poyer going to step up? Because that's the one thing that a lot of people, as I give them my knowledge, or a lot of people don't understand, is there are starters in the NFL and there are backups in the NFL. And there are starters for a reason and a backup for a reason. Now, that's not saying that a starter can't get demoted or a backup can't get promoted. But there is a discrepancy in talent from one guy to the next. And if Poyer had truly been pushing Gip, Poyer would have saw the field more without having Gip needing to be injured.
Injured, sure.
So that's kind of how, I mean, to answer his question.
He was the guy when they went to their quarter package, which was three safeties. He would get in there. He played, I thought, pretty well last year. We'll see. He's got to beat out Raheem Moore now, who is, you know, bigger pedigree in terms of the background, former second-round pick out of UCLA. The strong safety position now is seemingly Ibrahim Campbell's job to lose. He's going to have to compete, obviously. They brought in Derek Kindred that they drafted, but Ibrahim Campbell's guy that I know the last staff was high on, and I know this staff is also very, very high on, the safety out of Northwestern, who was an early fourth-round pick in 2015. I do think that this scheme is going to help us find out what we've got in Danny Shelton. I think Danny Shelton is going to have an opportunity to really be more effective as a disruptor in this particular scheme. Where does Nassib fit in? That's something that we all want to see. And I'm excited to see when they get out here for the rookie mini camp. He's going to get a lot of reps. I just think it's important for this team. You know, some of the tough decisions as you made, you want to get your young guys the reps. The chances of Desmond Bryant, Paul Kruger being here when this team is ready to contend for the playoffs are probably slim to none. Both in their 30s, both coming at the end of, or at the end of their contracts that they signed when actually Joe Banner signed them 4 years ago. So do you still want, because you need to have some veterans out there, do you still want those guys to be playing, or do you want to get Nassib and Ogba as many reps as possible? And if that's the case, you're going to want to make that decision so they can start getting them in practice and for the season. So I think those are the interesting questions that are going to be out there. You know, is it going to be something, do we see enough in the rookie minicamp to know that we're comfortable? Do we need to see it in OTAs? When do we say we're comfortable with these guys and we're going to go young, or we're going to have these guys waiting behind guys that are probably our most competent players right now in the front seven and have done it for the longest period of time in the NFL, but their reps mean no reps for the guys we draft.
Correct. And I think from a business standpoint, the dates or deadlines that we have to understand as Browns fans are that opening day roster. You know, once training camp is concluded, coaches, scouts, whoever's controlling, Asashi Brown controlling the 53-man roster, which he does, along with Hugh Jackson and Andrew Berry, what's the most cap-friendly decision to make as well? Because you leverage not only the lack of reps that some of your young players are getting, but yet these are you're saying they're your future. You're saying you're turning this thing around as fast as you can, but you've got expensive older veterans taking right. all those reps from your rookies. And as I said, the trial by fire, that's the one thing that you'll hear me say time and time again. Sometimes you got to throw a guy out there and let him fail so that he can succeed.
When you look at it specifically, let's say, with these young guys, how critical is it for them? Do you get the same experience and learning, et cetera, getting reps with the twos and the threes as you do with the ones?
Yes and no. And the reason I say that is because you do, there is something to be said about going through the motions and executing physically what you saw on a whiteboard, in a playbook, or during a walkthrough. Then you go and doing it full speed. That's a huge step of learning. But I think as you want to test some of these guys, if they're ready to run with the ones, you want to see them run against Joe Thomas and whoever our right tackle may be, whether it's, you know, Drango or Pastor or whoever, or Sean Coleman. I want to see Agba on Coleman. You know, you want to go best against ones against ones, big against big. And so that's what comes into play, and you start rotating those guys in little by little. And I think, but it has to happen at some point. You have to test these guys, because if they're showing flashes with the twos, that means that they're ready to make a step up to the ones. It's if they can do it, you know, for three consecutive downs or grasp the entirety of the defense, and you don't have to, you know, discount a certain portion of your playbook as we've seen done in the past, even at the quarterback position because of the young player.
How much can you tell about a guy as a pass rusher when the pads are not on and you can't actually, you don't have to finish? You know, that's one of the things, like when you watch a training camp or you watch, you know, in OTAs, when they do the team sessions, the pass rusher gets close to the quarterback and then it's like they consider it a sack. But finishing that deal is also hugely important. It's not just getting there. You know, guys like Ben Roethlisberger, that's one of the things they do so well, which is get, you think they're caught and then they get out of it.
That's hard to do, and there's really no way. And that's what the preseason is for. That's when you put the pads on. That's what the preseason's for. Take it out on the other team's quarterback, because those are your live reps with bullets flying. I guess if you truly watch pass rushers, whether you do it with pads or without pads, it's actually kind of irrelevant, because it's so much arms, leverage, hand fighting, hand placement, dipping and ripping, those sorts of things. And you can see that. If Emmanuel Ogba gets the opportunity on Joe Thomas, and Joe Thomas is essentially punching as if he would punch whether he had pads on or not with a helmet on, and Ogba's winning, you're on to something. That kid's got to get opportunities. It's just the way it goes. But so you can definitely tell who's got it. You judge their first step. You judge their leverage. You judge their wasted movement or non-wasted movement. Then, as Joey Bosa, the third overall pick, everyone said how great he was with his hands, how active he was with his hands. You don't want a one-trick pony.
Correct. How important is it then in your mind for Ogba to go against Joe Thomas every single day? How much will that help his development? How much did it help you in coverage going against Antonio Gates every
day? A ton. I mean,
so did it make it seem like when you played any, you know, Gonzalez was on that level, but every other tight end that you played in league, was it like, this is a joke?
Of course. Yes, it was. And the hardest thing is, it's the understanding between a rookie full of piss and vinegar, you know, trying to become a starter and wanting to prove to everyone that I deserve to be drafted where I was, make this football team, and start for this football team, and a nine-time Pro Bowler, and is he going through the? Is he? And I'm not saying Joe does this, but I'm saying, is he going at 80%, or is he going like he's going? Right. You know. And you have to understand that and take that into account when you evaluate these players.
Yes, you do. When we come back, we're going to take your calls, 216-578-0850. We're also going to go ahead and get a look at the running back position, let you know who's here on this roster at that spot, what you can expect from them. That's coming up next here on CBD.
listening to Cleveland Browns Daily on ESPN 850 WKNR.
Welcome back to CBD. Nathan Zgura, Matt Wilhelm, Jason Gibbs. Going to take a look now at the running backs, where the running backs stand headed into this season for the Cleveland Browns. We'll start right now with the guys on the roster as of today. You've got Isaiah Crowell, who was your leading rusher a year ago for the Browns. 185 carries, 706 yards, led the team in touchdowns as well, added 19 catches, 182 yards, and a touchdown. So for Crow on the season last year, 888 total yards and five scores. You've got Duke Johnson, third-round pick of a year ago from the U. Rushed for 379 yards as a rookie, no touchdowns, 61 catches, 534 yards, and two scores out of the backfield. He actually led the Browns backs in total yards from scrimmage on the season as he added for the year, 913 total yards and two touchdowns. After that, not a lot of people with much on their resume, if we're being honest about it. Raheem Mostert came in last year and was very effective for the Browns as a kick returner. He is listed as a running back, but second-year player out of Purdue, was mostly a kick returner last year. Came in, and I thought did a very good job with that.
He did.
You've got Glenn Winston, who is 27, but only in his third year out of the league. Was a big fan. Ray Farmer was a big fan of Winston's last year. Got into a game, his first carry, fumble. We'll see. Bye-bye. He will compete. 6'2", 220. Then you've got Terrell Watson. And Terrell Watson from Azusa Pacific, the NAIA Independence, a big bruiser, shattered every school record, including those that were set by Christian Okoye. 63 touchdowns over the last 3 years. Was on the Cincinnati practice squad a year ago. And came with Hugh Jackson. One of the first moves that Hugh Jackson made was to bring Terrell Watson here.
And just to interject right there, I think it's going to be Watson or Winston. Because I think in Winston, you get the big and physical, you know, the specimen that he is. So I think it's one or the other in this case, not both. So I think those two individuals are competing to make this roster.
Yeah, they are certainly in a competition. Raheem Mostert, really, you'd think would have to wow everybody. With all the people who have been brought in who had return experience, I don't see him just make the team just solely as a kick returner.
Now, the one thing that I we'll dive into, I don't personally believe there's much conversation with Sashi Brown and Andrew Berry, as well as Hugh Jackson's lack of attention toward the running back position during the draft, and then Hugh reiterating that in our draft special on the Browns Radio Network. How enamored he is with Isaiah Crowell as well as Duke Johnson. We're a two-trick pony. But you do need depth. And I think that's where Winston and Watson competing for that one spot. The other thing that I think can come into play is as we get into training camp, knowing you have a healthy Crowell and a healthy Duke Johnson, there will be players released that are expensive or they got beat out by a younger player on that roster, either drafted, undrafted free agent, or something of that sort, that will become available, that will, I believe, for the right price and in the right window, and the role that they will play for the Cleveland Browns would be very, very sexy for Sashi Brown to bring someone in with depth that can produce and has produced in the NFL.
Because you'd expect three tailbacks to make the roster.
Correct.
Mostert last year, by the way, 12 kick returns for 309 yards, a long of 53. He was very effective there. Has never taken a carry in the National Football League. He did return kicks last year for the Ravens, for the Dolphins, and for the Cleveland Browns. That has been his specialty, obviously, thus far in the National Football League. So you look at that room, and again, Crow and Duke are entrenched right now. Absolutely entrenched right now. Beyond that, it's a battle. Mostert, Terrell Watson, 242 pounds. Guy's a monster. Could he end up competing for the fullback job and be so that they could carry three and have him be a guy that could play some fullback for you and also run the football as a power back?
Very well could.
If you needed.
The other question that I have that I'll throw out while we're discussing the running backs is, how would you, and I guess I know that you know you are a Isaiah Crowell fan club team president.
Thank you.
How would you distribute the carries? Because the one thing that I have a feeling about, very similar to the way, you know, Giovanni Bernard and Jeremy Hill, you know, ran the football in Cincinnati, is a little bit more distribution. And I think, as we saw John DeFilippo last year, wanted to get Duke touches here and there because of the explosiveness that he brings to the table. Could that take some carries away from Crowell, you know, ultimately being the lead tailback?
Well, the way that he did it last year in Cincinnati, 223 carries for Jeremy Hill, 154 for Giovanni Bernard, 15 catches for Hill, so that's a total of 238 touches, 49 catches for Giovanni Bernard, so that's a total of 203 touches. So he did favor his power back ever so slightly in terms of overall touches. Now you go back the year before, Jeremy Hill, 222 carries, 27 catches, so 249 for him. Giovanni Bernard, 168 and 43, so 211. So both years that he had that two-headed monster there as the play caller, the power back, the primary runner, led the team in touches, led the team at the running back position. So with that in mind, you would expect Crow, for the first time, to get north of 200 touches. Last year, Crow had the buck 85 and 19. I'm saying north of 200 carries, I'm sorry. I think he'll get more than 200 carries, which he did not have last year. He did not have 2 years ago.
I think so, too. And I think in this scheme, it will fit Isaiah Crowell better. Because if you recall, coming off of 14, his rookie year, struggling to get his cleats in the ground, struggling to get north and south. And at times, that can happen in the zone scheme. When, as we know, and I'm not discounting anybody, but we weren't the most mauler-filled offensive line. And that's why the zone scheme fit us so well. Get a bunch of good athletic guys running laterally to get up on those players and capture that front shoulder, which allows our running backs to find those seams. Now these guys are coming at you, and it allows Isaiah Crowell a defined hole to do what he does best, is go forward.
Go.
Go. Yep. Hit the hole hard.
At the end of the year, they switched more to a power run scheme. Crow ran for 300 yards over the final four games, averaged 4.5 yards a carry, and scored three times. So if you could get that kind of production, I think Crow's going to go for 1,000 yards this year. I think if he gets 225 carries, which is he should in this offense, he's going to go for 1,000 yards. I think Duke Johnson is going to get close to 150 carries. I think there will be more of a commitment to running the football with the running backs in this offense than there was a year ago.
Because there's so many questions surrounding the playmakers and the reliability in our wide receiver room. You can't just drop back to throw the football just to throw the football. That's how you get beat. And I think Hugh Jackson will understand this once they get on the football field and have everyone together, rookies included, and he starts to understand what it's going to be. Because this, I don't want to say ball control, but we're not going to be ripping the ball 35 times a game. That's not winning football for this team yet.
It isn't. So you look at the last 2 years, Hugh Jackson's quarterbacks have averaged about 500 attempts. The Browns were at 650 last year. So you take that down, and then you look at the primary runners were just under 400.
Nine a game? Is that nine a game? Nine attempts a game?
More?
Yeah.
You're saying if they're, no, they were about 100, about 10. Yeah. 10. You're exactly right. Yeah,
right.
Nine. Correct. My math showing through there. Yeah, and those are going to be distributed into more rushes.
Correct.
For the two primary guys. So I think this is going to be a career year for both Crow and Duke Johnson in this offense. I feel pretty confident with that. The real question is, who's the third running back? Do they carry a fullback? Malcolm Johnson here, disappointing rookie year. They bring in no halfback with the 14 draft picks, no halfback with the 11 undrafted free agents, but they did bring in a fullback, Patrick Skov, who will compete with Malcolm Johnson.
Yes, and this is Malcolm Johnson, we thought would play a larger role and just all in all be a better athlete in last year's scheme and better touches. He came across
not
non-physical,
right.
Not physical, couldn't capture the edge. We moved him around. He was a great window dressing guy because he's an athlete. He can move around, but when he got to his end spot, wasn't very valuable, you know, to capture a shoulder or help out a Barnage, you know, trying to get up on a linebacker or whatever it might have been.
Often last year in Cincinnati, Hugh Jackson utilized a tight end in that fullback role. It actually was a tight end. They used Ryan Hewitt in that role a lot. He was the kind of the guy that ended up being their true fullback.
What is Ryan Hewitt's measurables?
Ryan Hewitt, 6'4", 246 from Stanford.
Sounds a lot like 6'4", 250 out of Princeton.
It does sound a little bit like that, but this guy was a blocker. It also could be, to me, the guy that if somebody on this roster was going to take that role would be Randall Telfer, because that's what he's here to do is block. But yes, it does sound a little bit like Seth DeVolve. I like it. All right. That's a look at the running backs. We'll look at the defensive line in hour number two. We welcome your phone calls, 216-578-0850. It's going to be interesting because, you know, Terrell Watson's got the connection to Hugh. None of the other backs do. Can he come in, win that third job? Can he play a little hybrid fullback as well? What happens with the traditional fullback? Do they go the way of the dinosaur so that you can utilize maybe a bigger back like Terrell Watson or a tight end like a Telfer? What happens with that spot? It's going to be interesting to watch. The one place where there really doesn't seem to be a lot of drama is who the two primary ball carriers are going to be in Hugh Jackson's offense.
Not at all.
Crow and Duke.
And that's a good thing.
That is a good thing because these guys need reps. They're going to get an opportunity to work extensively with Kirby Wilson, work their timing as they switch this scheme to much more of a power-based blocking attack.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why I think when you have an opportunity to draft a guy like Ezekiel Elliott, had he fallen to eight, you take him, right? But that was prior to hearing Hugh Jackson make the comments about Duke Johnson and Isaiah Crowell and understand exactly how high they are on both of these players and how they'll fit his scheme. And then lastly, knowing what he said about these players, adding the value of a player like Ezekiel Elliott, you know, at the eighth overall pick, would have changed up this dynamic. Crowell's questioning his role in the offense, his future in Cleveland. Duke Johnson's really more focusing on his role out of the backfield, more as a receiver, as he did as a rookie. But I'm sure he wants those 150 carries on the ground and be the playmaker both on the ground and through the air. It would have just changed up the whole dynamic of how we talk about this running back room. And now it's two guys and nobody else.
And it'll be interesting to see how those are worked out because those guys are both with the ones. And I hope that this year, and I think this is something that will come through, that we see them both used at times in similar situations. One thing that Hugh Jackson, obviously he threw the ball more to Bernard, but he ran many of the same plays from the same formations with both Hill and Bernard so that it wasn't automatically a tell.
Correct.
That if Crow's on the field, we're 100% running the ball. If Duke's on the field, we're passing the ball. So I think last year we were so specialized at times that there were too many tells in that regards for the opponent.
Which is hard. And do we have – when was our bye last year?
Late. I thought it was week 10, right?
Yeah, which I didn't like the 14 bye, which I think was like week four. So we've gotten kind of hit on both ends, and we'll have another late bye. What the bye week does from a coaching standpoint, it obviously allows the players to get refreshed, but the coaches do a self-scout. You get all the analytics of how predictable or unpredictable you are as an offense or a defense for that matter. When we line up Sean Merriman on the right side, how often is he doing this or is he doing that? And you really dive in and learn that. And you go out, you set forth, especially as a competitive group, to break those tendencies that you've created unconsciously through however many games. Because you're going to call the game to call a game. You know, Horton and Hugh Jackson, hopefully, they just call the game the way they call the game and the way the game determines. Those, they're not thinking, well, last time I ran it to the right, this time I have to run it to the left, just so I hold true. So those are all things that you evaluate as you go on. And I'm sure there's, you know, many individuals who, now that the draft's over, that those analytical people that get dive into the draft guys are doing some work on next year's prospects, but diving into football. Show me your value to the Cleveland Browns when it comes to us winning and losing every Sunday, because that's what this is all about anyway.
Finding ways to get those advantages and get those W's. The running back room, most stable it has been since I've covered this team in terms of no questions who the top guys are going to be. No fighting over it. It's going to be Crow. It's going to be Duke. And I would say to both of those guys, the tip of the cap, both have come back in tremendous condition. Crow easily looks the best that I've seen him since he's been with the Browns. Looks explosive, looks ripped. And Duke, an unbelievable athlete who came back and is in, I would say as well, in better shape, looking leaner, ready for a big workload this year under Hugh Jackson. That's our look at the running backs. We'll take your phone calls when we come back. 216-578-0850 on CBD.
You're listening to Cleveland Browns Daily on ESPN 850 WKNR.
Welcome back to Cleveland Browns Daily. Nathan Zagura, Matt Wilhelm, Jason Gibbs. Our friend G.I. George tweets us, my money's on Watson. Said Winston's been little more than potential. Watson has the benefit of knowing the system, knowing the staff, coming with Hugh Jackson from Cincinnati. How much of an advantage is that? Because I saw a quote today from Brock Osweiler saying the entire time it's like, in terms of learning the new offense and the verbiage down in Houston, he said it's basically like my entire life I've been taught to speak French, and now they're telling me I can only speak Spanish.
It's exactly what it is. And I mean, there were times where even as a rookie for me, you know, playing in a 4-3 defense and the way it was conveyed by one coach, and then in year two, we went 4-12 that year. We go to the 3-4 defense. You know, we make the transition very quickly. We go 12-4.
Were you nervous going from a 4-3 to a 3-4 since you were like, I imagine you were drafted to be a traditional 4-3 Mike?
Yeah, it was a 4-3 Mike. I really wasn't. You know, I think it was because of the kind of the failure that the rookie season was as a whole, that this team, as we sit right now, doesn't fit this scheme anymore, or, you know, fit the scheme. So the 3-4 defense was like a fresh new energy that, you know, kind of came in, and guys kind of fell right into place, you know, very easily. Made it fun. Wade Phillips made it fun. And I thought him talking about what we're going to do and the goals that we're going to accomplish, so on and so forth, was what made it, you know, made us what so great.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because in that defense, you know, you have the thumper. But in reality, in that defense, it's the will that's supposed to make the plays, right? Everything's funneled to that person to be the tackler. Whereas in a 4-3, the Mike is the one getting all of the tackles.
Yes, correct. You know, yeah, the Sam is this essentially a glorified defensive end in a stand-up position. Plays in coverage from time to time, as a Sam does in a 3-4. Kind of the same guy. But it's a shared duty. The Mike linebacker in a 4-3 is now, there's the two inside guys. And the weak inside linebacker in a 3-4 is predominantly, I hate to say it, but the prima donna tackling machine. Whereas the Mike in a 3-4 defense is the thumper.
So they want Kirksey this year to be that tackling machine.
Yes.
He's the playmaker.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
There's a lot of things you can do in the 3-4 defense, because if you like a guy in coverage over the other, you're not going to have – you can actually have Kirksey. Say you're on Tampa 2, and your run-through player is predominantly the Mike because he sets the front to the tight end. So the Mike is always to the tight end. Well, who's most likely to run right up the middle of the field? The tight end. I'd rather have Kirksey doing it. So Kirksey aligns at the Mike, runs through in Tampa 2. So there's some things that you can do to put guys in the right position to help your defense.
Does that then a studious quarterback would see – that is a tell if
It can happen late in a down, you know, happen late in a down. And that's the other thing that I need to understand to be able to eloquently convey my thoughts about this defense. Does Ray Horton, do they set a front? Do they play right and left? Because for the longest time, we in San Diego.
And what does that mean? Just to explain that.
I'm explaining it. So in San Diego, we set the front, which means there was a stud tight end or a tight end to the right. We set the front to that tight end, which meant the Sam linebacker, which was played by Sean Merriman, would always go to the tight end. Okay. And so Sean Phillips, the Will, would always be on the open side. And whereas in Dallas, and I'm just comparing it because DeMarcus Ware and Sean Merriman were the same draft. In Dallas, when they were playing the 3-4 defense, they played right and left. So DeMarcus Ware was always on the left. Whoever that other line's at, Anthony Spencer, was always on the right. So whether I was rushing against a tight end or, you know, hitting a tight end and chipping him on my way to the quarterback, you had to do so much more. Whereas we wanted our specialized rusher, Sean Merriman, to always be coming. So, and that's something that I need to figure out about Ray Horton's defense, because that's going to say a lot about the usage of Emmanuel Ogbah, the usage of
and that'll
Nate
be pretty
Orchard
easy. We'll just have to watch like five plays, and if they flip when the tight end flips,
absolutely,
you know that
yes,
they're setting
right
the front.
Correct.
Right. And if not, they're playing just right and left. Very interesting. It'll be interesting to see what he does there, because not only that, he will be using multiple fronts. So 3-4, 4-3 at times, you know, more likely 4-2-5 is probably what you're going to see a lot of. 3-3-5.
And actually, guys, I just had a caller. He was like, hey, I'm literally walking into a meeting, but I wanted to ask that question. What about a 4-2-5 defense? I mean, can it be played at the NFL level?
Of course.
But I mean,
that's your base nickel.
Can it be as successful as, you know, the 4-2-5s that we see and run in a lot of college programs?
Yeah, but isn't that your base nickel?
Yes.
I mean, in a 3-4, they'd probably call it a 3-3-5, right?
Yep.
But for the most part, that's just your base nickel. So you'd have four in that. I bet you would see, if I'm guessing, let's say it's a nickel and we know they're passing, of the guys that are currently on the roster, I bet you'd see Ogba on one end, Nassib on the other end, maybe Dez for an interior rush, and then what, maybe Shelton?
John Hughes. If you're rushing the passer.
Right. So you would have... You'd move, basically, you'd put Ogba would go from outside linebacker to DN, and then you'd have probably Kirksey and DeMario as your two linebackers mm-hmm. in the middle, and then you'd have your five DBs.
Yes.
Yeah, and then in a 3-3-5, that's more when you have like Von Miller and DeMarcus Ware, so you're still running your three underneath, you got your two on the outside, and you have the one linebacker in the middle. Your Mike would play kind of center field. Yeah, I think a 4-2-5, that's pretty standard, is it not?
Very standard. It's not even called 4-2-5.
It's called nickel.
It's called nickel.
Right.
Yeah.
And teams can get there. Some teams will get there with outside linebackers as opposed to defensive ends. But, yeah, that's basically what you're doing there. So there it is.
Would you like to take a phone call for me?
Question answered. Yeah, well, let's get one more call in here, and then we'll go ahead and take a look at the defensive line. So this is a nice lead into that. Kevin in Brecksville, welcome.
Hey, guys. And what you're saying there, Matt, is, you know, it's really great analysis and stuff. But then I think this is my point about the coaching and stuff is that, you know, the offense or the quarterback will see what you're doing on defense, and then and he'll know where to slide the protection or where to take the back out, you know, to work against, like you were saying, Marion or whoever, to the side that he's coming from. You know what I mean? And to me, what I'm saying is coaching, and I think the Browns are going to be way better at that this year, is the coaching. Because to me, in the NFL, especially nowadays when you don't practice as much or practice with your pads or anything, coaching is huge in the league. You know what I mean? And I think the Browns are way ahead of what they were as far as coaching. And I just wanted to ask Matt if I was watching some of the other NFL Network and they were showing clips of coaches, and they showed Bill Belichick, like, during the game going over and talking to an individual guy about, you know, a defensive lineman about, he was saying, you got to come at this different angle, you know, with your hands and your body. And I just want to know, do you ever see, like, the head coach doing that as much as Belichick? I mean, it's just crazy to me that he's over there talking to this one individual during the game about that.
Yeah, very rarely do you find, you know, I would say a defensive-minded head coach coming over and talking to the defensive group, because there's just a lot of faith in that defensive coordinator that, you know, is an extension of the head coach who's a defensive-minded head coach. So he conveys all that information. I think you see, In my experience, you know, with Norv and Mike McCarthy, you know, would deviate away from the game briefly to go make a point either to the offensive line, to the running backs on a certain play, or to the quarterbacks and make his point and then make his way back to, you know, wherever the line of scrimmage is.
He's like, listen.
Yeah. It's few and far between. I think Belichick probably does it more.
And that's where he started. I mean, he is a defensive coach.
Correct. And so in some cases, he feels like I need to go do this, you know, and say this, because it's a hell of a lot more profound coming from the head coach, especially when it's Bill Belichick, than it is Matt Patricia.
Because he's arguably the greatest of all time. Dog Pound, the second annual Cleveland Browns Fan Fest, is coming to First Energy Stadium this Saturday, May 14th. Join the Cleveland Browns 2016 rookie class, alumni, coaches, members of the front office, and other special guests. Tickets are on sale now. Visit clevelandbrowns.com or the mobile app for more information. All right, when we come back, we'll take a look at the defensive line, which is now an interesting group. A lot of tough decisions will be made. How will playing time be divvied up? We'll take a look at that, our first guess, when we come back here on CBD.